Hello there. Welcome to Cool Climate Living. I'm Susan Lacey. Among the many talented people who live in the Central West are our writers. In Oberon, the Oberon Writers' Workshop is celebrating 12 years of writing and fellowship with the publication of an anthology. This includes work from the workshop writers and invited authors and contains a diverse range of stories and genres from fiction, science fiction, humour, poetry and life writing. The variety of work from the 14 local authors explores a wide range of experiences, both real and fictional, from deeply personal to humorous. In today's program, I'll be speaking to the writers who've contributed to the anthology. And you can join the launch of the anthology on November the 9th between 6 to 8pm at the Oberon Community Centre or at the presentation of the Oberon Library at 10:30am on the 14th of November. You'll be able to hear about how the writers got started and what motivates them to write. Now, my first guest in today's program is Janet Ballew. Janet has been very closely involved in putting together this anthology. Janet, why did you decide to do this in the first place?
Anne Russell, who had been the coordinator of the group for the last 12 years, was moving to Tasmania. She needed someone to take over the act of coordinating the group. Somehow, not quite sure how, really, it fell to me. And one of the reasons I went ahead with the anthology was because everybody had been talking about doing it. And it had never happened. So I thought, well, Anne is a very relaxed, outgoing, friendly person. We'll see how they cope with a termagant like me. And so we started getting organised. I started anthology meetings and everybody submitted stories. And so it started in motion. And then when we had all the submissions in, one of the members of the group, who also is one of the writers, Inara Hawley, has had a lot of experience in compilation and putting stories together, bringing them to a stage that they're ready to go to the printer. So fortunately, Inara took over that rather onerous task and it gelled and everything started coming together.
Now, Janet, all of these writers are all from the Oberon district, aren't they?
Oberon, there's a few from Bathurst, but Oberon and areas around Oberon, yes.
Are they all in writers' groups?
If they're not all in them now, they have been. Most of them are members of the Oberon Writers' Workshop. There are a few that are members of the U3A Writers' Group, and there's a couple that aren't associated with any writers' group. What I tried to do was bring in and open up the anthology so that it wasn't just the writer's workshop that was the centre of the anthology, but that it took in the talent from the entire area, because there's a lot of writing talent in this area.
So of the writers who've contributed to the anthology, as you said, there's a lot of talent throughout the Oberon, Bathurst, this whole region, really.
Absolutely.
How did you get them interested in contributing to the anthology?
Inara knew a couple from one of the other writers' groups, and basically I just asked. My mother always said to me, you have a tongue in your head, use it. So I did.
And did it take long to get together?
Everything began around about the end of February, and then
February this year,
2019. And then once I had a group that were all ready to contribute, I thought, well, let's keep it in a democratic manner that everybody shares in the decision making. This way we know everyone is happy about what's happening, which has been one of the priorities in the way I've managed this. So it's, generally speaking, gone very smoothly. Everybody's pulled their weight. Inara was my right hand.
It must be a great sense of achievement to know that the anthology is now ready to be launched.
It's going to be launched in November. The 9th of November is the official launch date, and that will be at the Robert Hooper Centre in Oberon between 6 and 8pm in the evening. There's also going to be a presentation at the library on the 15th, which is a little bit different to the launch, and it's aimed more for members of the library and possibly people in the older age group.
And that date is?
The 14th.
Of November.
Of November, correct.
Janet, let's move from the creation of the anthology itself to your own writing. You have contributed a couple of pieces to the anthology. Now, I can certainly see the reason why you decided to manage this whole process, but what inspires you to write anyway?
The first thing I wrote, I was 12 years of age, and it was a Christmas present for my mother. It was a poem. I enjoyed writing it. I've found that writing is a wonderful way of really looking at myself, of taking stock of things. Sometimes I call it emotional vomit. Other times I call it expression of elation or something of that nature. It's me processing my experiences and me.
And do you have a particular style that you could describe?
I constantly try not to be too didactic. Because I can sound like a lecturer at times. I try to just really communicate feelings. Mm-hmm. And I also like to communicate concepts. I self-published a book in 2013, which was essentially my trying to explain what life is all about. It was essentially on paranormal psychology. I do a lot of writing about my experience with my horses. So it's me processing me.
Now, you've got a couple of pieces in the anthology and you're going to read one out to us. Tell me a bit of background about this particular piece.
This piece centres around one of my most loved horses. If I get emotional, you're going to have to forgive me. His name was Orlando. He was a straight Egyptian Arabian stallion I imported from Germany. He was possibly mentally and temperamentally the most beautiful horse I've ever known. And I sold my property in 2000 or 1999. And I just couldn't bring myself to part with him. I dispersed my other horses around different studs, but I couldn't bear to part with Orlando. And because of his bloodlines and the fact that he was imported, he was in demand by a lot of studs. I had many people wanting to buy him, but I wasn't prepared to sell him. So if I found the studs suitable, then I would let Orlando go to their stud for a period of time. So he moved between, I think, three or four studs over the years from 1999 to when he died. He had an accident and he was in a paddock. He was running with mares and he got caught on a fence. Unfortunately, the person who was the owner of the property and was having Orlando at the time was in Sydney taking her parents to the airport, and she didn't find him until, probably 18 hours or more later. Mm. And it was really funny because the night before, I had a dream. Orlando and I could talk to each other in dreams. And he came to me and he said, "I want to get to Egypt. I've got to get to Egypt and I'm hung up. I can't get to Egypt." And I didn't know what that meant. So I rang this woman and she'd only recently discovered him. Long and the short of it is he'd severed an extensor tendon and we took him to the vet in Dubbo, and he also, unfortunately, had a stress founder. We tried to save him for about 14 months, and we didn't succeed. Yeah. I bought this property here in the hope that if we did save him, he'd come, and we could live here together. Mm. But it didn't happen.
Oh, Janet.
So I found out about his death the day I exchanged contracts. So it was quite a story.
Janet, let's hear the piece that you've written.
It's called "The Wind Howled Down the Chimney." Walking over her land, connected again to the earth, her mind wandered. She had always had a sense of when her family, loved ones, or beloved animals who had passed on were around. Like the Chinese Taoists, she believed the ancestors, the family, stayed around to keep her safe and guide her. Why this was so, she didn't really know, but it was a useful belief because it helped her make sense of life. It made it easier to cope with loss and sadness, and there had been a lot of that. Was it her imagination? Who knows? but she knew when she sometimes got a whiff of almonds, then her mind would hear something her husband, John, would used to say. Can I read that again?
Yep.
Was it her imagination? Who knows? But she knew when she sometimes got a whiff of almonds, her mind would hear something her husband, John, used to say. When she was lonely, trying to work out the best way to act, she would feel the touch of his hand on the back of her neck. It was always comforting, bringing a momentary touch of affection, the intimacy so sorely missed. She had bought this small property to bring her stallion, Orlando, home so they could grow old together. They had been separated for many years because of life's circumstances. No matter how many people wanted to buy him, she always said no. She knew their connection was a lifelong one. He had spent their years apart enjoyably and well cared for at different studs around the country. Being a straight Egyptian horse, his bloodlines were in demand. He sired hundreds of foals over these years. Unfortunately, he died the day she exchanged contracts on the property. His death and her deep sadness were her last thoughts as she returned to the new house. Not long after, on a windy, blustery day, an electric storm, typical of spring, was coming. Everything was unsettled and edgy. A sense of unease pervaded. Gathering kindling, she went inside to light a fire. As she opened the door of the firebox, the wind howled down the chimney and ash blew in a cloud into the room. A sense of a presence surrounded her. The fire now ablaze, she decided to sit quietly for a while and see what she could make of the feelings running through her entire body like electricity. Then the lightning flashed. Thunder followed ominously. It sounded as if it was on top of the house trying to break in. In her mind's eye, she saw Orlando running from the trees into the centre of his paddock. His eyes were large, even for him. His nostrils flared, snorting steam. She sensed him calling her outside. Large trees surrounded the boundary of the property. She didn't think they would hit the house if they fell, but the image that had just flashed into her mind made her decide to check things outside. She grabbed her dryer's bone, her telephone, and a torch, put the dogs on a lead, and with them went out into the night. She walked to the centre of her garden where there were no tall trees. A bolt of lightning flashed down and hit a big eucalypt, splitting it apart. It was on fire. Then another flash hit the house. The thunder was vibrating through her being. Then suddenly the wooden veranda was ablaze. Standing there aghast, she pulled out her phone and rang the emergency fire number. The fire was now raging through the long, dry grass in surrounding paddocks. Smoke was also filling her house as the floorboards burnt. Thank God she and the dogs were not inside. Having tied them to an ornamental maple, she grabbed the hose. Still the wind howled as water slowed the flames. Then the magic sound of sirens. Help was on its way. She felt the tweaking of affection on the back of her neck. The smell of almond wafted around her. Was it just her imagination? Whatever it was, she was glad she had heeded her vision of Orlando and was greatly comforted by her sense of John. As usual, she wouldn't talk about it. She was already considered odd by most of the village.
That's marvellous.
Thank you.
Thank you, Janet. We've just heard from Janet Bailey and Janet's wonderful piece about, well, a lot more than about Orlando, but he's clearly the star of the piece.
Yes.
That's marvellous. Thank you very much,
That's
Janet.
A pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
people say I must. I've got to stay true just as long as he needs me. If you are lonely, then you will know when someone needs you.
Next we're going to hear from Brian Beasley. Brian has been a poet for a very long time. He specialises in a lot of bush poetry. By the way, Brian's got a terrific memory because he can often recite his poems. And Brian has also won a number of awards. The Henry Lawson Memorial Award, is that it, Brian?
Henry Lawson Literary Awards at Gulgong, yeah. And at Grenfell, and Roth Boldrewood Award at Dubbo. Numerous other awards around the country.
How long have you been writing poetry?
Probably about 25 years now.
Now, why did you start?
Well, strangely enough, I wanted to improve my spoken English. And the only way I could find I could perhaps do that was to enrol in a creative writing class. And the first assignment we had was to write something like a short story, more or less, about the natural world. So I started to write the story about a river. The River's Lament, it was called. And as I completed a couple of paragraphs, I read over the work and I noticed that a few of the lines rhymed. So I thought, I might try and turn this into a poem, which I did. And that was the very first poem I ever wrote. I was really over the moon with it, but when I look back on it now, it was a pretty average piece of work. But nevertheless, it was the first one I ever did.
So the type of poetry that you write now, I mean, I've described it as bush poetry. I don't know if that's too generic a title. But how would you describe it?
Basically bush poetry, I suppose. I also like to write traditional verse, also sonnets and sestinas.
What's a sestina?
Sestina's a tricky sort of a structure. It comprises six stanzas of six lines each. And the end word of each line reoccurs in the following, in a predetermined order, in each verse.
Yep.
And then it ends with a three-line envoy at the end with the one of the words in the middle of the line and at the end of each line in that three-line envoy.
Right.
So it's very disciplined, which I enjoy doing.
Mm. Yeah. So all of your poems, too, seem to reflect a vision of your Australian background, is that right?
Yes.
And maybe this is one of the reasons why the Henry Lawson Award context really works so well for you too.
Yes, I'm one of those people who happen to think Australia has a proud history. Prosperity we enjoy today just didn't happen overnight. It happened with a lot of hard work and sweat and sacrifice from our early pioneers, and that should be appreciated and noted.
And that comes through very strongly in all the poetry that I've heard you recite.
Yes.
All right, now that sounds fantastic. Thanks, Brian. Brian, tell me what piece you're going to read out and where did the idea come from?
The piece is called Inland Mission. It's about the Reverend John Flynn. And my wife and I did a tour up through central western Queensland. It was called the Matilda Highway. And when you come to Cloncurry, there's a wonderful museum dedicated to John Flynn. And you don't really understand what he faced in trying to get the Flying Doctor service up and going. Because flying and radio were in their infancy when John Flynn had the idea of creating the Flying Doctor service.
Was he a doctor himself?
No, he was a religious minister, I think he was Methodist. I think he was.
Well, his history is part of Australian folklore now, really, isn't it?
Oh, quite iconic. It was amazing what he achieved. Mm. And I believe through reading various articles about him, he had this ability to be able to draw people to him to help him establish the Flying Doctor Service. Mm. Like the people at Qantas gave him an aeroplane, the very first aeroplane that they used. They flew it from Cloncurry to Julia Creek, and that started it off.
And I guess that if he hadn't have put together that essential medical service for rural people way, way, way out back, that would have taken a lot longer for our own flying medical services to become established. Do you think that?
Oh, for sure, yes. He did it very early in the piece. As I say, the flight and the use of radio was very much in its infancy when he established it.
And he had doctors and nurses on board as well?
Yes.
Yes, a fascinating character. I can understand why you decided to write a poem about him. Okay, Brian, why don't you read it out to us and we'll get started from there.
Okay, it's called Inland Mission. I had the strangest meeting after walking up and down in search of light refreshment in a Queensland outback town. The pub was nothing fancy, just a bar with shabby stools, a faded snooker table and a list of simple rules that hung above the mantel for the players to review, in spite of being useless when they had had a drink or two. The sun was slipping slowly down a brilliant autumn sky as looming shadows crept across the hotel floor, and I was welcomed to a shandy and a barman's grudging curse, then noticed in the corner an old man who looked the worse for wear, in keeping with the pub's surroundings. Then he spoke, inviting me to drink with him. I warmed to that old bloke. His piercing eyes betrayed his worn, despairing looks, and it was obvious to me that he had knocked around a bit. No sooner was I seated when he started telling me about the Flying Doctor and the legacy that he had given all Australians, no matter black or white, about his true disciples, who are noble in our sight. He touched on how, with nurturing, a good idea can grow, the early days at Curry and Alf Traeger's radio. He mentioned names like Hugh Mackay and Simpson once or twice, and dedicated nurses who were bred on sacrifice, and Hudson Fish, who gave to Flynn a DH-50A, the victory at Julia Creek on that historic day. The old bloke hardly paused at all to give his tongue a rest. Instead, he talked some more about the hardship further west, of pioneers who travelled where the timid never go, to spread a safety mantle through the great outback, although I doubted his credentials, thought he wanted charity. But what he had to tell me next has always haunted me. It seems he ran a station somewhere south of Arnhem Land and went to muster bullocks with his hired station hand. The scent of promised moisture wafted heavy on the breeze, which stirred the lazy bullocks seeking shade among the trees. The leaders broke in frenzied rush beneath his cracking whip. Before he knew, a feisty bull had ripped him knee to hip. The station hand assisted him and stemmed the bloody flow, then sought the nearest homestead with a pedal radio. The earphones crackled loudly as a voice began to say, "Location? What's the problem? Flying Doctor's on the way." They stitched him up as best they could, suggesting further care, relayed him to the waiting plane and blessed him with a prayer. I needed time to reckon with the pictures in my head, but then he gently shook my arm before he calmly said, "I never was religious, though I did believe in fate. But as we climbed towards the sun beyond the boundary gate, the shape of wing and fuselage imprinted like a brand, the eerie shadow of a cross against the sunburnt land." His sober story stirred me, and my pride in Flynn has grown. Who needs imported heroes when we have Australia's own? And now I'm here in Alice, on the western side of town. A river gum is sighing, and the sun is streaming down, reflecting from a monument of sacred origin, where lies an outback legend by the name of Reverend Flynn.
That was wonderful, Brian. How long ago did you write it?
Oh, dear, that must have been, I'd imagine, about 10 years ago or more. Could have been more than 15.
Did you win an award for it?
Yes, that won the Outback Writers Award at Dubbo.
Well, and now in the anthology, for plenty of other people to hear it as well.
Yeah, I hope so, Sue, yes. I must say also that never in my wildest dreams did I ever think I would be able to write poetry, least of all award-winning poetry. So I just wanted to inspire people, to, if they have an inkling for poetry, give it a go and get all your thoughts down on paper first, and then try and rhyme it and see how you go, because it can be done. I'm no expert, and as I say, I never thought I'd be able to do it, ever.
All right, that's marvellous. Thank you very much, Brian. We've just heard from Brian Beasley. Brian is a well-established poet in the Oberon district and has published and been awarded for a lot of his poetry and writing, with a very, very strong commitment to Australian heritage. Brian, thanks very much for joining the program.
Yeah. Thank you, Sue.
Lady, are you crying? Do the tears belong to me? Did you think our time together was all gone? Lady, been dreaming, I'm as close as I can be. I swear to you, our time's just begun. Close your eyes, rest your I promise I will stay right here beside you. Today our lives were joined, became entwined. I wish you could know how much I love you. Lady, are you happy? Do you feel the way I do? Are there meanings that you've never seen before? Lady, my sweet lady, I just can't believe it's true, and it's like I've never ever loved before. Close your eyes and rest your weary mind. I promise I will stay came entwined. I wish that you could know how much I love you. Lady, are you crying? Do the tears belong to me? Did you think Our time together was all gone. Lady, my sweet lady, I'm as close as I can be. I swear to you, our time has just begun.
Now, the next person we're going to hear from today is Inara Hawley. Inara has been writing for about 10 years, and her main interest has been about life writing. And as well as writing about her own life, she's done a lot to help other people write about their own life histories. Inara, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Sue.
What's the fascination about life writing?
Well, I'm fascinated by life writing because our stories connect us, and exploring them can be life-changing. That not only leaves a legacy, it can unearth epiphanies, it can be healing. We can often become more aware of our purpose. Our life stories not only connect us to who we are, they connect us to each other. And because sharing our wisdom is so inspirational. And everybody has a story.
Indeed they do. Indeed we do. Yes. Thinking back to when you first started, do you remember what the first piece was?
Well, my life writing journey began in 2008 when my mother, who was 85 at the time, asked me to write her life story. And the reason was because she was a post-World War II refugee to Australia. She wanted the grandchildren to know what they'd gone through to give them a good life in a free country. Mm. And I guess I always wanted to write because I relished the challenge. I really, really enjoyed it. What I discovered, of course, was that while it was my parents' story, it was also mine because it was a journey of self-discovery.
Mm.
Yeah, it always is. It always is. It took 2 years to write, and the first year I spent visiting her every week and getting her stories down. And the second year, I did the historical research and did the writing and I polished it. And interestingly, researching the history of ancestral lands is not only fascinating, it's also very heart-connecting because the individual is always part of the whole. And so that's a very fascinating process in itself, just doing the research. But it was 60,000 words and I self-published it for the family. I then went on to write my husband's biography, and then, of course, I was hooked on life writing.
Right, yes. In writing your mother's story, so your mother came from
Latvia.
So in researching and writing your mother's story, you would have learnt a lot about Latvian history and your mother's experience.
Absolutely. In fact, at the beginning of the book, I wrote a complete historical list from the very, very beginning to today, to date, you know, it was 10 years ago, because Latvia was owned by many different countries over the years, and Europe, all the boundaries of Europe changed over the years through all the history, and that in itself was fascinating, and the language is interesting.
Did you learn to speak Latvian as a child?
Oh yes, when I started school I couldn't speak a word of English. Yes, that was no fun at all.
No, I can imagine.
That was very difficult actually. Mm. I went through school very much alone because of it.
Yes, and writing can help you to work your way through all of those sorts of...
Yes, it certainly can. You connect it very much to who you are and why you do what you do and purpose, as I said before.
So you've gone on to write life histories for a number of other people?
Well, I've done a few. It depends what people give me. They can give me their bits and pieces, and then what I will do is I will ask them a million questions and research the background history of the country generally and put it all together and into something that is interesting, because life writing does take the same curve as fiction. You still have to write it in a similar way as a story arc, so that you hook the reader and you start with something that's really interesting and the reader says, wow, that's interesting, and then they move forward. And there's always wisdom, always a lot of wisdom in people's stories, and that's so inspiring.
And how would you describe your style in writing these life histories?
I personally write fairly concisely. what's important is if I'm doing it for other people, especially when I did my husband's, I had to be very careful to keep his voice. When I wrote Mum and Dad's story, that was different. I wrote it, it just came out and flowed out of me because it was such an emotional journey. But when I wrote my husband's, I wanted to keep his voice very much. So it's an interesting process to do that.
Yeah, it'd be a challenge.
As Janet mentioned earlier, I have put the anthology together, but I have very good experience, knowledge in putting a book together, and that's something I can do quite easily. It just depends what people want from me. I can get all of their information, I can edit it and put it together, or I can write it for them. It just depends what they want.
Let's have a talk about the piece that you're going to read to us.
The story I'm going to read today is the story of my mother's early life, which is relative to our earlier conversation. It's called Dreams Do Come True. My mother had a very difficult early life. She spent her whole childhood in a tuberculosis ward, 9 years, with tuberculosis of the spine. Her mother had tuberculosis and died, and it was a killer in those days. And during that nine-year period, all of her family died, pretty much, except for her grandfather. And he wasn't able to take her because the state didn't allow it because he didn't have the room. And she ended up in a home. And this story is about what happened to her during that time and how she got adopted.
Okay, let's go to that piece now, Inara.
Dreams do come true. Move along, be quick, get in line. Harsh voices, loud noises, pushing and shoving. It's late 1937, 2 years before the Second World War, and the place is a European orphanage. A desolate and very unhappy young girl is living a miserable existence. Her legs are scratched and bleeding from the rough woolen socks she is forced to wear, and her feet are wet because she has no gumboots. She is lonely and she is sick. For you see, she has spent most of her young life in a hospital isolation ward for tuberculosis of the spine. When it was time to leave, she had no family to go to. Her parents and her grandmother had long since died, and her only close relative, her grandfather, was a broken man. He lived in a cramped one-room attic, and the authorities would not allow him to take her. "Get your hands off, that's mine." Too many bullies. The safe refuge of the hospital that had been home for 9 long years is gone, and daily life is now about the survival of the fittest. But her lungs and spine are damaged and she is weak. Having to fend for herself and deal with the harsh daily regime is not easy. She sleeps in a 20-bed dormitory. Her only private place is her bed, and her life is dominated by bells. There is a bell for washing, for dressing, for eating, for school and for sleeping. Bell after bell controls her every movement. There is never a moment to recover. She must be sharp and fast. She must even fight for food. It is a case of the quick or the dead, and she is not quick. "Don't you know how to walk?" She is slow. Getting around is difficult. There are lots of steps. She doesn't walk like other children, nor can she run and play, as she still wears a back brace. And because her gait is different, the other children ridicule her and often push her over. Years of living in an institution has left its mark. She is insecure and fearful. So she speaks to no one, and no one speaks to her. "Please, please send me a miracle." She prays every day, clutching the parting gift given to her when she left hospital, a book of her favourite stories. One has captured her heart. It tells of an angel sent to earth at Christmas to find a mother for a destitute orphan. The angel searches and searches, and on Christmas Eve finds the mother he is looking for. And in saying the words, "With the love in the light of a candle flame," the angel brings them together. With her very soul, this young girl believes it is a true story, and with burning faith believes it is also her story. She sleeps with the book under her pillow, and with an open heart, whispers the words every night, praying to God and the angels for her miracle to come true. So deep and intense is her belief that she is convinced her prayers will be answered with the coming of Christmas, only weeks away. She is sure the angels will send her a mother, exactly the right mother to fill her life with love. "Oh, my child, my heart bleeds. The rescuer comes. In this lonely existence, one day she has an unexpected visitor, her grandfather. He is not happy that his granddaughter is in an orphanage and has come to see for himself what her life is like. And what he finds breaks his heart. Before him, he sees a life of poverty and struggle, not what he wants for his granddaughter. Once a wealthy man, his only solace now is alcohol. But suddenly, courage and purpose dormant for so long, grips him. He knows what he must do. He is still owed money from the days when he was a rich man, and if he couldn't get the money, he was going to make sure his granddaughter's needs were met. And so, without ceremony, he turns on his heel and makes his way to the doorstep of the man who is still in his debt. "Why are you here?" When the door opens, he barges in, blustering and demanding to be heard. And a few minutes later, they know the reason why. And now they have a decision to make. Yes, they owe him money. Yes, they are obliged. But they do not trust him. They will not pander to the demands of an alcoholic. He knows that, and up until today, has not come begging. But now he demands and says the child's needs must be met. After all, he tells them, you are a God-fearing man of honour. His words and actions set in motion powerful wheels. The wife of the man he visits decides to go to the orphanage to see for herself this child the old man is so passionate about. She is a kind and loving woman, and it is with a caring heart that she sits beside a tiny, frail young girl in the dormitory of the orphanage. And as if it were heaven sent, the girl beside her instantly knows that this is the miracle she has been praying for. This kind lady with the loving eyes is her mother. She is certain of it. And without a second's thought, she looks up into the face of compassion and utters the words which changes both their lives. Mother, when are we going home?
Oh, my God.
Every word is true.
Yeah, well.
Every word is true.
Mm.
It's quite a story, isn't it?
Sure is.
I know.
Yeah. Beautiful, Inari. Just beautiful.
Yeah, thank you.
Inari, thank you very much for joining the program today.
Pleasure.
Going to be joined by Denise Starkey. Denise is a keen writer and she has been doing this for at least 5 years,
And most of her writing has been around short stories. And most of her stories have been around Dalmatian dogs. Denise has bred dogs, she has trained dogs, and she has showed her dogs. And a lot of her dogs have appeared in commercials all over the world. Denise, thanks very much for joining me today.
You're welcome.
Denise, tell me how it is that you got started with writing.
The first reason I started to write was to do a history of the family for my children, so that when I'm no longer here, nobody would forget what had happened in the past. Then I branched on to a lot of the experiences I've had in the advertising world with my Dalmatian dogs.
So the stories that you're writing now, are they always about dogs, or are you writing about other things as well?
No, I think I have a very eclectic mix of stories, but mainly about the dogs at this point.
Well, they're beautiful looking creatures, aren't they?
Oh, glorious. Then that's a silly question to ask me.
That's right. Do they have a particular personality?
Yes, they do. They can be very naughty, but contrary to popular opinion, they are very trainable. You just have to have a little bit of patience.
Well, I guess if you are training them to appear in commercials, you'd have to train them very thoroughly.
Training is extensive, but I initially trained them for trialling purposes, and then that training led on to being able to do the television commercials.
And do you still have dogs?
No, I don't have any anymore.
That must have been hard to give that up.
First time in my life I haven't had a dog, it's very difficult.
Oh, so now you're writing about them.
Absolutely.
Still plenty of memories there.
Yes, the memories keep me going.
Let's talk about the piece of writing that you've got in the anthology. What's it about?
Initially, my dogs were the face of David Jones many years ago.
Oh, really?
And did a lot of David Jones commercials. And then I was asked to take two dogs to their spring fashion parades, which worked out well, but we had a few little incidences as well.
All right. Do you want to start reading it to us now?
Yes, I will. I've titled it Spring Fashion. Spring, a season for love, for watching the garden burst forth with new life, and of course, fashion parades. Early one spring morning, I received a phone call from Angela, my animal agent. In the mid-90s, Tara, my Dalmatian dog, had become the face of David Jones' advertising campaigns. It stood to reason that she would be required to become part of their spring fashion parades. Two dogs were needed to walk the catwalk with one of the models. I selected Tara and BJ for this particular exercise, because of their happy, laissez-faire attitude to life. They really knew how to strut their stuff, so to speak. The parades were to be held over 5 days, two per day, at David Jones' Elizabeth Street store in Sydney, culminating with the final parade on the Friday evening for VIPs and celebrities. We set off early on Monday morning and parked in the Hilton car park, ready for our short stroll down Castle Ray Street toward David Jones. I didn't anticipate that short stroll would become a stop-go affair, mainly stop. We were in the middle of the busy morning commute, people everywhere, hurrying along to their everyday work lives. For many of them, stopping to quickly pat the dogs put smiles on their faces. This was obviously something they didn't expect to see in the hustle and bustle of a typical Sydney weekday morning. Finally arriving at our destination, we were escorted to the second floor landing that was to become our home for the next 5 days. I laid out the dogs' beds, settled them down, and proceeded to give them some quick grooming. No fashion parade is complete without a complement of child models for the children's fashion range. And so it was with this. 4 children who were housed on the third floor landing. It seemed this was almost a Ben Hur-like production. Over the week, Tara and BJ performed their duties in exemplary fashion. Almost. We arrived each morning to the delighted squeals of the children as they raced down the landing shouting, "The dogs are here, the dogs are here." There was one little boy who hung back, wanting desperately to pat and hug the dogs as the other 3 children did. His fear of dogs, however, held him frozen on the stairs. Tara and BJ were a calm and easygoing pair, so over the next 5 days I was able to introduce Aiden to them on a step-by-step basis, going very slowly so as not to heighten his fear. For me, that was the most rewarding experience of the entire week. To see the joy on Aidan's face as he no longer held back and was able to experience the pleasure that patting a dog can bring. Eventually, Friday arrived and everyone was on their best behaviour, ready for the VIP and celebrity parade. No one told Tara and BJ, however. BJ did have one very annoying and sometimes embarrassing habit. He was inclined to poke his nose up ladies' skirts. Even my mother's full-length dressing gown was no match for BJ when the mood took him. It never crossed my mind that he would decide to perform this particular trick on the last day in front of all those special guests. BJ, forever the showman. The model was wearing a very full, flared tulle skirt with copious amounts of petticoat, all of which apparently became too much for BJ to resist. Halfway down the catwalk, it seemed that he could hold out no longer. Up under the skirt went his head, to the shock of the model and the laughter and applause of the audience. Tara obviously thought that BJ was onto something, so she popped her head in to see what was going on. The audience kept laughing hysterically and applauding loudly. The model, to her credit, handled this unexpected situation with great aplomb and exited stage left. Instead of becoming a complete disaster, it became the highlight of the night, bringing an ordinarily mundane fashion parade to life. Remember the old adage, never work with children or animals. Ah, oh, well.
And I bet it's a true story.
It is a true story.
We've been listening to Denise Starkey. Denise has had a terrific experience in training and working with Dalmatians and also a terrific sense of humour in her writing. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you very much, Sue.
You've been listening to Cool Climate Living. I'm Susan Lacey. Now, what you may not know is that you can participate in Radio 2MCE in more ways than listening to this program. You can subscribe. For every subscription, we can deliver great community radio and you even get some freebies. Subscribers can also get involved with 2MCE's online presenters or behind-the-scenes volunteers. Subscribers help with equipment upgrades and new technology and resources and presenter training. So if you'd like to know more about how to become a subscriber, go to our website. Thanks for joining me today. See you soon.
Fly me to the moon. Let me play among the stars. And let me see what spring is like on Jupiter and Mars. In other words, hold my hand. In other words, baby, kiss me. Fill my heart with song and let me sing forevermore. You are all I long for, all I worship and adore. In other words, please be true. In other words, I love you. Song, let me sing forever.